Make sure you get out and vote November 28th.
Wait, what? When? November 28th? Okay.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
Never is.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
Nah.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara, 93.7 FM in San Diego, 99.5 FM in Ridgecrest and China Lake, up in Oregon on 91.7 FM KYAQ on the Central Coast, 106.7 FM Queso in Cottage Grove, 93 FM WLRI in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, 88.5 FM KAKU in Maui, WGRN 94.1 FM in Columbus, Ohio, and 102.9 FM WLPP in Palenville, New York, not to mention AM 950 KTNF up in Minneapolis, St. Paul. And yep, we are streaming on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR Revolution 99, Detour Talk, Radio Monterey, and Radio Sputnik, blanketing planet Earth 5 days a week, whether you like it or not. I'm Brad Friedman. This is The Bradcast, and I am your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com, just trying to keep our heads above water in the final stretch here. How many? About 27 days, almost 25 days left until this long national nightmare might, and I underscore might, be over. We'll see. Sorry. Call them like I see them. That is, of course, Desi Doyen, our producer. How are you, Des? You holding
right.
up? Okay, good.
Yes, yes. I'm ready for this election to be over.
No. It's very exciting. People in the media, they love this stuff. They love elections. It's all about, you know, explosive headlines. And this is, of course, when the mainstream corporate media makes all of their big money on campaign ads and everything else. Maybe that's why I don't love it quite so much. We don't take money from political organizations or corporations and so forth. But anyway, I got to call it like I see it. Speaking of calling it like I see it, coming up, those WikiLeaks emails. WikiLeaks has been on a tear since last Friday, at least, releasing almost daily now what are believed to be thousands of hacked private emails to and from Hillary Clinton campaign chief John Podesta. There's been a lot of those headlines I was mentioning about them. Explosive, this and that. And, well, is there really any there? We will speak to a Clinton supporter, I think it's fair to say, who says, yes, there is, well, sort of some there. As usual, we will try our best to cut through the noise, because there is plenty of it out there, and try to make sense of it all so you can understand it, so we can all understand it. Moving away the corporate media nonsense for ratings and everything else, just trying to understand it. Thanks, by the way, to those of you who allow us to do that by stopping at bradblog.com/donate. That is greatly appreciated. All right, so that's coming up shortly, but also some breaking news as we go to air. A number of breaking news items, in fact. Wells Fargo CEO John Stumpf is, they call it retiring. What he's doing is resigning. He's been pushed out. The company says this after regulators had accused the bank of creating more than 2 million bogus accounts. Not just regulators accused, Wells Fargo has admitted as much. And we played a few weeks ago when John Stumpf was hauled before the U.S. Senate. We played Elizabeth Warren's just absolutely excoriating questioning of John Stumpf. And what do you know? Real oversight by Congress on real issues actually works, at least to some extent. It has finally, it seems, succeeded in pushing this guy out.
At least to some extent. I am curious if the Wells Fargo Corporation is going to claw back any of the something like $200 million in profits and pay that he made in a higher stock price from those fraudulent
from
sales
yeah.
tactics.
Well, that's right. That's true. He says he retires. Doesn't say he was fired, and they're asking to get that money back for consumers. So we'll see. But you're right. At least a little bit of oversight there. That is breaking. We'll learn more about that in the coming days, I suspect. Also, we spent yesterday talking with the Daniel Smith down in Florida, great election expert down there, about what's been going on in the fight to extend voter registration for Floridians. After they were displaced over the weekend, the past weekend, by Hurricane Matthew, the governor, Rick Scott, who, by the way, hates the idea that you folks in Florida might actually vote. He refused to extend the voter registration deadline, despite the fact that he had forced more than a million people to evacuate with the storm coming in. He was right, I think, to order that evacuation. But then when he was asked about extending the voter registration deadline, this was the final weekend for voter registration. The deadline was Tuesday of this week. That's the big, and as Daniel Smith on our show yesterday explained, more than, 116,000 new voters in Florida had signed up during roughly that same period, the last 5 or 6 days before the registration deadline back in 2012. 116,000 voters. So, and those voters would be ultimately disenfranchised this year, those same new voters, about 100,000 of them. So, some good news. A federal judge on Wednesday has extended the voter registration deadline by 6 days in the state of Florida. So, Democrats had sued for this to try to make this happen. The judge he was not satisfied, let's say, with Governor Rick Scott's reasoning for not extending the deadline. He wrote, when he had extended the deadline by just one day until today, now a hearing was held today, and he has since extended it by a week. But initially, he said, it has been suggested that the issue of extending the voter registration deadline is about politics. Poppycock. Federal Judge Mark E. Walker wrote, this case is about the right of aspiring eligible voters to register and to have their votes counted. Nothing could be more fundamental to our democracy. So good for Judge Mark E. Walker down there in Florida. Another week, unless I guess the state of Florida could appeal this decision and say, no, we don't want them to have another week to register. And this is not just Democrats registering to vote. This is all voters being able to register to vote. So Scott had said, everybody has had plenty of time to register. I don't intend to make any changes. That's what he said last week on the same day he was ordering an evacuation of Florida. So some good news there. Okay, by way of public service announcement, because I'm feeling so generous because of that today, for Donald Trump supporters, this is a public service announcement for you. Here's what Donald Trump told you yesterday in Panama City, Florida.
We're doing something that's incredible. It's a movement. But if we don't win, all it is a little asterisk in history. There's never been anything like this. So go and register. Make sure you get out and vote November 28th.
Okay, now, never mind Donald Trump's little asterisk.
Asterisk.
Is that what he said?
Yes.
Never mind that. No, don't go out and vote on November 28th. Now, Republicans for years... maybe there's evidence the Democrats have done this over the years. I don't know. But it's been a dirty trick that you say, you tell people the election day is a different day than it actually is. Democrats the Republicans.
Republicans
vote on Tuesday. Democrats
vote next week
on Wednesday. Yeah. So, no, the election is not, despite what Donald Trump said, it is not November 28th. It is actually November 8th. Tuesday, November 8th. Just wanted to make that clear in case there was any question about it.
So it was Donald Trump dirty tricking himself?
Kinda, yeah. Well, dirty tricking his own supporters, apparently. He's tired. I'm worried about him. I'm worried about his health.
Does he have stamina?
Yeah. Does he have the stamina? He should also smile more. Anyway, so that's Donald Trump. Public service announcement for you Trump supporters, and I know you're listening. I hear from you all the time. In the meantime, as I try to find something, anything positive to say about the toxic, dangerous, indescribably dishonest Trump-Pence campaign. This audio tape, this video, has been making the rounds in the corporate media a bit over the past 12 hours or so, but really just one part of it. I want to play the whole thing. And Des, we may need to stop and start here a little bit.
All right.
Because apart from the first part that has been playing a little bit on cable news, there is actually a bit more that I'm trying, in the spirit of fairness. I want to give some credit to Indiana Governor and Republican Vice Presidential nominee Mike Pence. I want to give him some credit, a little bit here. Now, there are two parts of note here. The first is the part that's been played a lot. His comments in response to a woman that people are calling Revolution Rhonda. Some are calling her at a rally where he spoke yesterday in Newton, Iowa. Small rally, by the way. Small crowd, small room. But his comments in reply to her call for revolution have been lauded by many, and maybe they are praiseworthy, but there was a little bit more because he also spoke to her comments about voter fraud. So let's move through this a little bit here. Here's the first part, the lady's question and Pence's initial response.
My name is Rhonda.
Rhonda?
And I'm on social media every day, all day, nonstop.
Yeah,
since last June.
I mean, not me. I mean,
no, pushing Trump. And one of the biggest things I can tell you that a lot of us are scared of is this voter fraud. Yeah. There's a lot
They're
of us
scared.
That are out here
They're
saying
scared.
That we go to vote, we're going to wear red.
Okay.
Our wow. lives depend on this election. Our kids' futures depend on this election. And I will tell you, just for me, and I don't want this to happen, but I will tell you for me personally, if Hillary Clinton gets in, I myself, I'm ready for a revolution because we can't have her in.
Yeah, you don't say
But that. I'm just saying it. No, you know, I'm like Trump. You know, do I not speak for people here? Do I mind not saying the truth, guys? Come on.
Yeah, there's a revolution coming on November the 8th. I promise you.
Okay, hold it there for a second here. We'll just hit that. So that's the first part where he's saying, no, we don't need a revolution. The revolution comes on November 8th, not November 28th, but November 8th. Mike Pence, you know, saying, no, the revolution is at the ballot box. It's with the ballot, not the bullet. So good for him for saying that. I don't understand that we're going to wear red part. Maybe that's a thing now. They're all going to wear red. Meaning, who knows? I don't know. The woman says they're ready for a revolution. Really?
She sounds very upset.
Yes,
very
she's very upset. She is scared. She's scared, terrified about voter fraud. Voter fraud by these Democrats because, as we've talked about for years on the show, Republicans pretend there's massive voter fraud going on at the polls, etc. All right, continue the tape.
What are we going to do to safeguard our votes? Because
Girl, look,
we've seen how the Democratic Party is just crooked, crooked, crooked.
Well, look, I'll tell you, number one, it's, you know, elections are administered at the state level. They are. And I'll tell you, in the state of Indiana right now, we got a pretty vigorous investigation into voter fraud going on right now. And in the state of Indiana, and I encourage you here in Iowa, everybody, is let's be sure, whether it's Secretary of State or whoever, let's make sure that our elected officials are upholding the principle of one person, one vote. And the best antidote to that is to be involved in the election process. There, if you are concerned about voter integrity and you haven't signed up to be a poll watcher, to volunteer at a polling place, to be a part of the integrity of that process, then you need to do it. Because I truly do believe it is that the right to vote is a sacred right that was won and was protected by these men and women in uniform. And for our part, we defend it by maintaining the integrity of the system.
Okay. Now, that was once again Mike Pence, vice presidential nominee, responding to Revolution Rhonda, as some are calling her. And he's right and he's wrong on a couple of parts. One, elections are run at the state level. So I guess what he's suggesting here is that the federal government, Barack Obama and his big vote stealing machine, I guess, can't come in and control the elections. And Mike Pence would sort of know this. He's the governor of Indiana. So, you know, what he's saying is, no, we control, not the federal government. We, at the state level, we control our elections. And in fact, the state of Indiana is one of the, actually the first, I believe, to institute photo ID voting restrictions. So they've already got photo ID voting restrictions in Mike Pence's state. He says the elections are administered at the state level. He says we have a vigorous investigation into voter fraud going on in Indiana. Now, in fact, there is no investigation into voter fraud going on in Indiana. There is a, let's call it, vigorous investigation by the state police into voter registration fraud. And I don't want to get into the details right now. Maybe we'll do it in the future. But suffice to say, this is one of those things. Remember those Acorn investigations that would always crop up right before the election, and they would basically shut down these groups that were doing voter registration perfectly legally, not committing voter fraud, not committing fraud, not even committing voter registration fraud, but actually going out and registering to vote tens of thousands of new voters. And in the case of Acorn, they were low and middle income voters. So God forbid they should have access to their franchise. So we've got to shut down Acorn and pretend they are defrauding the system. There has never been, there is no evidence, none, of any fraudulent vote ever cast due to an improper registration that was created by Acorn. Well, the group in Indiana is kind of like one of those groups. At least that's what it appears. They actually check. They claim to check each and every voter registration that they get, that their workers collect. They claim to check it to make sure it's not fraudulent before they turn it in. And if they find something questionable, they still have to turn it in, but they flag it as potentially fraudulent or problematic. It's missing a zip code. The voter has got their, put their phone number incorrectly, transposed some numbers, but they can't change it. They have to turn it in as is and flag it. And pretty much every year, Republicans go out and they say, voter fraud is going on. These groups. Now, what it does, There has been raids across the state of Indiana by the state police, taking away their computers, their cell phones, claiming that there is some sort of massive voter registration fraud going on by this group. Indiana Voter Registration Project, I think, is the name of the group. We don't know much more than that. The head of the group says that's not the case, says we flag anything that's a problem before we turn in the voter registration form. He doesn't seem worried about it, other than the fact that they had to stop their voter registration drive because the state police, Governor Mike Pence's state police, have essentially shut down this operation. We will see what they have when they come out. But if history is any indication, what we've seen in the past elections with groups like Acorn, nothing comes out. There's, maybe a worker who feels, who doesn't go out and do the registration work that day and so fills out some fraudulent names. Of course, those people don't vote because they don't exist. And it's, in the case of Acorn, it was always caught by Acorn. We'll see if that's what happened here or not. We don't know. But in any event, it is not voter fraud, as this woman suggested, and as Mike Pence suggested. So he gets no credit for that. So he gets credit for saying no revolution, but vote on November 8th. Credit for that. Not credit for saying, even suggesting, there is some sort of voter fraud going on in Indiana. But here's where I wanted to give him credit, because I'm so generous. He said, be involved in the election process. He used the word voter integrity, and in truth, the voters are doing fine. Leave them alone. But election integrity, he says, be involved in the election process. If you haven't signed up to join the party, to become a poll monitor or a poll worker, do it. And I agree. Do it. Whether you're Republican, Democratic, you can call your favorite political party and sign up. Get training on what to watch for, how to not be stalking people and intimidating people at the polls. If you're a free agent who Donald Trump has called for to, you know, just go out to the polls and intimidate people and question and challenge. No. Sign up with one of these groups who are doing poll watching. They're all over the country. All the parties have them. Participate in the process. If you participate in the process, you will learn there may be a whole hell of a lot less there than your Republican overlords in this question, in this instance, are suggesting. So I want to laud him for telling people to take the right action. No revolt. You should vote and you should participate in the process. Be a poll worker, be a poll monitor, be a poll watcher. All that is good. But try to be an official one. Sign up, get information on how to do it rather than show up with your red sweater and declare revolution. A quick break and we were back with questions about these WikiLeaks emails. All of that and more on the broadcast right ahead. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
What's next, WikiLeaks? What's next, WikiLeaks? What's next?
Yes, what?
Don't stop now, we're on the edge of our seats.
Well, maybe an overstatement.
What's next, WikiLeaks? What's next, WikiLeaks? What's next?
Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Yes, WikiLeaks has been on a tear the last several days. Beginning on Friday of last week, on the same day that the Washington Post released that Access Hollywood videotape of Donald Trump. So a lot of this has gotten lost. And then, of course, there was the Sunday debate, etc. But they have been on a tear. Beginning on Friday, they released a trove of private emails sent to and from Hillary Clinton's campaign chief, John Podesta, thousands of them. And they have been releasing even more ever since in the days since Friday. Thousands of, many media folks at least have been going through them ever since, including me over the weekend, late last night, etc. The WikiLeaks emails being released seem to fall into three general categories. Entirely fake emails, for example, John Podesta calling Bernie Sanders supporters a bucket of losers. Now, I don't know that WikiLeaks actually released that themselves, but that was one of the emails that was floating around that people were claiming came from WikiLeaks. And then there are presumably real emails. A lot of it has, in my opinion, just become sort of a fever swamp of gossipy intra-party bitching and politicking. In other words, not particularly newsworthy, and sort of the sausage making of democracy known as modern day politics. Stuff that is real and maybe embarrassing, much as it would be if your personal emails were unleashed in a world full of people looking for some reason to confirm their bias against you. That you're terrible or you're corrupt or they just want to embarrass you. But maybe it's interesting stuff, but I haven't found it particularly newsworthy, at least not much of it. And frankly, troubling that these private emails to private individuals showing no illegalities or public business, that these things are being unleashed on the public. That's sort of the second category. And then there's the third category, the stuff that's actually newsworthy in some fashion. It may come from an otherwise private email, but its publication actually serves a public interest, such as the case, for example, with the emails. This is part of the batch that was released on Friday, citing concerns from the transcripts of various private paid-for Hillary Clinton speeches made to groups like Goldman Sachs and so forth. These are the speeches that she has long refused to release, despite calls from Bernie Sanders and folks in the media to do so. There are snippets from those transcripts, from those private speeches, and that seems newsworthy to me, at least in some respect. They came up, those snippets of those transcripts, at least, came up during the debate on Sunday night Here's the question and answer that was asked of Hillary Clinton, and then we'll get to Donald Trump's response to it in a second.
WikiLeaks release of purported excerpts of Secretary Clinton's paid speeches, which she has refused to release, and one line in particular in which you, Secretary Clinton, purportedly say you need both a public and private position on certain issues.
As I recall, that was something I said about Abraham Lincoln after having seen the wonderful Steven Spielberg movie called Lincoln. It was a masterclass watching President Lincoln get the Congress to approve the 13th Amendment. And I was making the point that it is hard sometimes to get the Congress to do what you want to do. And yes, President Lincoln was trying to convince some people. He used some arguments. Convincing other people, he used other arguments. That was a great, I thought, a great display of presidential leadership.
That was Hillary Clinton responding to the question about the transcripts where she suggested you need to have a private and public position on policy. Donald Trump thought that was just absolutely ridiculous, quoting Abraham Lincoln there.
She said things, WikiLeaks, that just came out, and she lied. Now she's blaming the lie on the late, great Abraham Lincoln. That's one that I haven't... Okay, Honest Abe. Honest Abe never lied. That's the good thing. That's the big difference between Abraham Lincoln and you.
Okay, so that was Donald Trump's response. Now, if you look at these actual transcripts, Hillary was right. This was a speech for a National Multi-Housing Council, apparently. Again, we are presuming that these transcripts, this section of the emails released by WikiLeaks, are actually accurate, in which the campaign was concerned about this speech. Is this something we should worry about? Her saying you have a private and public position. Well, she says, if you look at the transcript, you just have to sort of figure out how to, getting back to that word, balance, how to balance the public and the private efforts that are necessary to be successful politically. And that's not just a comment about today. She said that, I think, has probably been true for all of our history. If you saw the Spielberg movie Lincoln and how he was maneuvering and working to get the 13th Amendment passed, and he called one of my favorite predecessors, Secretary Seward, who had been governor and senator from New York, ran against Lincoln for president, and he told Seward, I need your help to get this done, et cetera, et cetera. She goes on to describe the effort to pass the 13th Amendment by Abraham Lincoln. And that sometimes, she says, the sausage, I mean, politics is like sausage being made. It's unsavory. It always has been that way. But we usually end up where we need to be. But if everybody's watching, you know, all of the backroom discussions and the deals, you know, then people get a little nervous, to say the least. So you need both a public and a private position. So Donald Trump accused her of lying. I see no lie. I see that the text backs her up in this case. But what else is in those speech transcripts released by WikiLeaks from John Podesta's emails that voters need to know about, if anything, before November 8th? What do they reveal? What do the transcripts of these long-sought private speeches to groups like bankers at Goldman Sachs actually reveal? Well, David Atkins is here to tell us after writing about them over the weekend, where he described them as problematic, at least in some respect, for Hillary Clinton. David O. Atkins is a writer, campaign professional, and researcher who blogs for Washington Monthly's Political Animal. And David, you were on a tear this weekend about not just this, but a lot of stuff. Welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Hey, thanks for having me, and I'm happy to be here.
Great. Glad to have you. All right, let's start there, and then we can get into some of the specifics. But why are the excerpts of those speeches, specifically as you wrote about over the weekend, presumably the parts of them where the Clinton campaign had some concerns about these transcripts becoming public, why are they problematic as you see it? Because I'm not seeing them quite as problematic. And believe me, I've been looking. I've been trying to find what's troubling and problematic about it. And so far, I'm striking out.
They're problematic, politically speaking. They're not problematic in the way that a lot of people are trying to make out, mm-hmm. which is showing her actively corrupt or colluding. And I think that was a big mistake, I think, that a lot of Sanders supporters made, which is that there's been a lot of accusations against Hillary Clinton that her that she's literally pay to play in terms of corruption. The right wing makes that argument. Certainly members of the far left have made that argument. And it's not really true, and it goes to a misunderstanding of how politics actually works, which is most people aren't actually overtly pay-to-play corrupt. And Hillary Clinton isn't either, by any account. Like, we've now had 5 releases of these Podesta emails, and while there has been some potentially uncomfortable stuff in terms of maybe cozy relationships between reporters and the campaign, mm-hmm. or maybe too much contact between the campaign and maybe some of its PACs, although certainly the Republicans are doing that like crazy as well, there's not really much there in terms of corruption allegations. When I said they were problematic, what I meant was they confirm a lot of what Bernie Sanders supporters had suspected about where her actual political instincts lay. She moved left significantly over the course of the primary, mm-hmm. sort of catching up with Sanders as she understood that the Democratic base was more progressive than it had been in the 1990s. And I think what she said to Goldman Sachs confirmed that she's much more in the center mm-hmm. than, and I hate using that word, it sounds good, but it's really not. She's much more of a sort of Wall Street-friendly bent than the Democratic base would necessarily have been okay with had these things been known.
I think the argument you seem to be making is that, and actually you write as much here, that these transcripts frankly would and should have been a big problem for her had they been released during the Democratic primary. You know, I'm not even sure of that. And I know that I'm going to catch a lot of hell from people claiming I'm some sort of a Hillary flack. And by the way, I think you guys over at Washington Monthly have been very, very pro-Hillary. I think that's fair to say, is it not, David? I don't want to...
Generally the authors, I'm probably the most flame-throwing lefty of the authors at Washington Monthly. You know, Martin Longman mm-hmm. is, you know, pretty close to Bernie sympathizer. Nancy Letourneau has been mm-hmm. on Clinton's camp. But yeah, the Washington Monthly generally has been a fairly center-left publication over its time. So I'm happy to write there and provide a more Occupy-ish, Sanders-ish sort of perspective.
Hopefully,
like, with some serious reason behind it.
Yeah, no, I know. And that's kind of why I wanted you to come on and talk about it, because, you know, if anyone at the Washington Monthly, you'd have a reason to find a problem here. But, you know, when you look at it, it's one thing when you take these quotes out of context, as they did with you should have a public-private position. And, you know, she responded, well, that was about Lincoln. And you look at the documents. That is exactly what the documents say. When you suggest, David Atkins, that you know, Bernie Sanders supporters might have found evidence that here that she was more in the center than they would have liked, well, she has sort of said that publicly as well. Looking again at the actual transcripts, Clinton's, this is to a remarks to Xerox, I guess, a private speech to Xerox in 2014. Whoever's interviewing her says, ask her about Democrats. She says, oh, I'm long on Democrats, definitely. Republicans, she says, unfortunately, at the time, short. The questioner says, okay, we'll go back to questions. And Clinton adds, we need two parties. We need two sensible, moderate, pragmatic parties. Now, if that's the most damning thing you can come up with from these speeches, and in many regards, I found that it was just about the most damning thing. I've been asking people on Twitter and elsewhere, what troubles you about this? And, you know, they point to stuff like that, that if you look at it in context, you might not agree with it, but isn't it kind of what we all already know about Hillary Clinton and we've known for many years?
Right. I think yes and no. So there's a lot to unpack there. First of all, I should mention, of course, that Washington Monthly is, you know, nonpartisan. So none of us are actually like endorsing candidates to mm-hmm. the magazine or anything. Now, that having been said, in terms of Clinton's speeches, yes, like the idea that there should be two moderate, sensible parties, that's actually one of the least objectionable things in the speeches, although people focus on that. The other thing that people focused on way too much was this public position, private position thing, which is easy to throw rocks from glass houses, especially if you've never actually had to try to negotiate in any sort of organizational setting. If you've ever tried to lead a large group of people, you know that you have to be able to negotiate behind the scenes. That's also not actually objectionable. I think the parts of the speeches that would have caused her problems and that are upsetting to those of us of a more rational progressive bent is her endorsement of the Simpson-Bowles framework as good. Right? That's not okay. And that would have caused her a lot of problems had it been released during the primary because the Simpson-Bowles framework is atrocious. And, you know, folks like Digby and I were going crazy over this back during grand bargain days of Barack Obama.
Can you explain for people for people who don't know? Can you explain in general what Simpson-Bowles was that she is saying? She says that Simpson-Bowles is generally the correct framework. She says the big elements of it were right. What is in general Simpson-Bowles? If you can explain that in easy simple terms here.
Yeah. So Simpson-Bowles is based on the public figures that. That are responsible for it. I think their names are Alan Simpson. I don't remember who Bowles' first name is.
Erskine Bowles. Yeah.
Erskine Bowles. Yeah, yes. There you go. And these are deficit reduction warriors, right? They believe that reducing the deficit is the primary goal of American policy for them, which, of course, Paul Krugman and a lot of liberal economists have pointed out would be a terrible idea and we don't really need to worry about right now when we're in a still sort of recessionary environment at almost negative interest rates. Like, the last thing we need to be worried about is deficit reduction. We can borrow money very cheap. They want to reduce deficits by dramatically cutting back on spending and by raising taxes. Now, the stereotype of Democrats is of people who want to raise taxes, but we don't want to raise taxes. We want to be able to pay for programs because we know that raising taxes, while it doesn't do as much damage as Republicans say it does, is obviously a, it comes at a cost, right? The less money people have to spend, the less the economy can expand, and we want to tax people at the very top who have way more than they can use, and the very rich don't actually spend it, they just sock it away. And we want to be able to pay for programs that make people's lives better and that make them feel safer and richer and freer so that they will actually spend money. For instance, if you create healthcare for the poor, then they're not wasting their healthcare money. They're healthier, and theoretically, they're able to spend more money. You give people better education, then the economy grows. That sort of philosophy of economic growth. So what Simpson-Bowles wants to do is cut spending a lot, which of course is recessionary, right? That is incredibly damaging.
Right.
And they want to raise taxes. It's the worst of both worlds, with the goal of eliminating the deficit, which is not a goal that we really need to be worrying about right now. And those and the deficit hawks, are incredibly damaging. But there was a huge amount of conventional wisdom on both sides that said that we needed to be following that. And following that is not a good idea.
Specifically, she says, this is a speech to Morgan Stanley. She says, you have to restrain spending, you have to have adequate revenues, and you have to have growth. And I think we are smart enough to figure out how to do that. She's talking about the Simpson-Bowles framework, those three things: restraining spending, adequate revenues to pay for government services, and you need to grow the economy. And frankly, your explanation of it, David, this is all such wonky, in-the-weed stuff that actually this business about Simpson-Bowles, I think it underscores your point that this might maybe have hurt her against in the contest against Bernie Sanders, but it actually helps her, I would think, if anybody pays attention to it right now in a general election, at least with Republicans who support in general this stuff. But again, hardly explosive. I read a headline, I think it was today at Vanity Fair, a list of the, quote, 8 most explosive things in the Podesta emails. And none of them were explosive at all. I hate to say it, and I think you actually get at the same thing in your coverage, that ultimately, maybe there's some stuff that could be troubling to folks on the left. And when you take these words out of context, it can be made to be used against her, as Donald Trump dishonestly did in that speech. In that debate. But so far, I still don't see very much. Now, there's a lot. There's thousands of them out there, and WikiLeaks is releasing them every day, and maybe there will be more, and maybe there will be something that catches her or Bill Clinton or something with their hand in the cookie jar. But, I mean, this is kind of wonky stuff. This is, you know, not the Access Hollywood bus, that's for sure.
No, it's not. And that's why I want to be, like, I'm straddling the line in terms of defending Clinton on the merits of, like, We're now in the middle of Podesta Leak 5. It just sort of dropped half an hour ago or something.
Mm-hmm.
And the thousands and thousands of these emails, you would think that given the way House of Cards and a lot of, you know, people for picture politics, that if a person like Podesta's private emails were made public, that you would see all sorts of seamy, pay-to-play corruption and vicious, like, knifing of people and punishing people. You're not seeing that, right?
No.
The worst that's coming out of Podesta's private email box is that the DNC really did play favorites with Clinton, which is a known thing now.
Mm-hmm.
And Bernie Sanders people have a right to be upset about that, but it's also not surprising. You know, when you fight the establishment fights back. That's what it means to fight the establishment. We can be upset. It's not surprising, and heads rolled, right? Debbie Wasserman Schultz is out. Donna Brazile, who is, by all accounts, a fair operator, is in. The allegations against Brazile from these emails are ridiculous and way overwrought. So there's already been accountability on that one.
Mm-hmm.
The other things that have come out are, again, a bunch of people who don't understand how communications works are talking about the co-relationships between reporters and staff, but that happens on both sides of the aisle, and it's how communications work. You find a friendly reporter, you pitch them stories, the reporter might write up your stories and get quotes from you. That's not corruption. That's how it works. Like, hello, it's ridiculous.
Well, and that's why, you know, I'm... In one sense, looking at these transcripts, the excerpts from them that were in the emails that were, you know, apparently according to Podesta and or the people writing to him, these are the ones, these are the snippets they were most concerned about. I don't understand if this is it. If this is the worst, it makes me think there's got to be more. Because going through the snippets that they had from those paid speeches makes you wonder, why the hell they didn't just release it in the first place? I don't see anything, and I'm not even sure you argue that it would have been more damaging, you know, in the primary with Bernie. I don't even see them that way. For example, there's one part where she's actually lauding single-payer health care, which publicly she had said we will never, ever have. But here she is, you know, citing Sweden's single-payer and Canada's single-payer as if something she supported. That seems like that would help her in her case against Bernie Sanders in the primary.
Yeah, so here's where I'll disagree with you a little bit. I, of course, agree on the universal health care thing 100%. Where it would have hurt her in the primary against Sanders is that she tried to portray herself as agreeing with Sanders on the policy, but disagreeing with him, or on most of the policy, but disagreeing with him on the approach. That she wanted the same things as him. She wanted to hold Wall Street accountable. She wanted to accomplish the same things, but she knew how to work the levers of power better, and Sanders was a crazy person who would never get anything done, and she was the pragmatic progressive who would accomplish things. And what the Sanders folks said is, that's not true. You're being dishonest. You don't actually have the same priorities with regard to Wall Street that the Sanders people do, and you're faking this for the primary, was essentially the argument. And what the speeches do show is that she does have a significantly more center-left approach to Wall Street. Now, some people have said, well, of course, she was giving a speech in front of them. What do you expect her to say? Well, okay, but, like, then don't take money to give speeches to Goldman Sachs then. if you have to say things that you don't believe. But I think most of us believe that she does believe these things, and among them are, and this doesn't make her very different from President Obama, by the way. Like, the Bernie people have the same criticisms of President Obama, that he was, you have to remember, from during the 2014 sort of era, there was a huge focus on deficit reduction. It's part of how we got the sequestration in the first place. That wasn't just the Republicans pulling that off. There were a huge number of Democrats who were pushing that as well. And there was this talk that she was giving about how Wall Street's role in the collapse of the economy had been overly politicized, and that it was going to take a lot of cooperation from insiders on Wall Street who knew how it worked, and that we really needed to work with moderate regulations. You know, whereas the Bernie camp was like, no, these people are terrible. They knew what they were doing. They collapsed the economy completely, and you need to break up the big banks and prosecute them and hold them accountable. Those are very different messages, and I think had those speeches come out, the contrast between Clinton and Bernie would have been much greater. The other last thing I want to mention is the open borders, open trade thing would have really been damaging, because, of course, the TPP was a huge, huge issue. And that's the one thing that could hurt her in the general election. Like,
but
here,
but only if you take it out of context again.
Yeah.
I mean, she says my dream is a hemispheric. She says my dream is a hemispheric common market with open trade and open borders sometime in the future, with energy that is as green and sustainable as we can get it, powering growth and opportunity for every person in the hemisphere. That was to some Italian bank or something. Again. So, okay, who cares? Isn't that everybody's dream to have an open world where everyone does well and we all share? And I mean,
it's not, though. I mean, and here again, where I straddle the fence here, I defend her because I actually agree. Like, I consider myself sort of a globalist socialist type. I believe that, you know, people trying to protect jobs for people in their own nation state as opposed to some other nation state isn't really much more morally defensible than protecting jobs for someone of your own race or your own gender. Like, it's just another form of discrimination as far as I'm concerned.
Right.
But I'm in the minority there. Both on the right and on the left, you have a large number of people that are very upset, and rightly so, that corporations, say American corporations, have been taking jobs away from American people. And making a lot of money by hiring overseas people at far cheaper, at slave wages, basically. And they have a right to be upset about that, and a lot of people don't want a big open borders, open trade thing, because, you know, in order to have that, the only way that doesn't lead to a race to the bottom with massive inequality is if you have some very serious sort of radical wealth redistribution strategies like universal basic incomes or massive government jobs programs. I mean, Hillary Clinton has not shown any inclination toward radically restructuring our economy. So I think people start to get upset, and probably rightly so, in my opinion, when you have someone who is an incrementalist in terms of policy change, who also is advocating for the eventual dissolution of borders and completely open trade. Because incremental policy plus open borders and trade is a disaster for regular workers.
Unless you have, you know, rules and restrictions on minimum wages and all sorts of stuff like that. And I hate to, I mean, I know, I realize I am completely coming across as if I'm some sort of a Hillary Clinton apologist. And I don't even know that I'm going to vote for the woman. I'm just trying to deal with you know, the facts. And you look at, and this has come out today, I don't even know if you saw this yet, David, but Matt Stoller noticed from the Podesta emails that Clinton herself had ordered opposition to the TPP because she doesn't like the investor state, the ISDS, the Investor State Dispute Settlement Court. That's this extra legal investment court that I hate personally in TPP. I know a lot of critics do, that, you know, that allows you to, you know, companies to have this process that they can challenge actually laws, you know, American laws and so forth. She was against the ISDS months and months before she even stated, her opposition publicly to TPP. Many people said it was in response, obviously, to Bernie Sanders' opposition to TPP, but these emails show she was against it like a year earlier. She also opposed the Keystone XL pipeline about 6 months before she said so publicly and before Barack Obama ultimately and officially rejected it. I don't know. I'm trying to get worked up and concerned and furious and outraged about these emails. But so far, I'm striking out. That's
right. And I'm agreeing with you on 80% of it.
Okay.
I think there's some stuff in the emails to be upset about that Sanders people especially have a right to be upset about. Number one is that they were right about the DNC collusion, and especially with the mm-hmm. fifth batch that just been released, there's even more evidence that they were jiggering debate times, and it was really sort of collusive. Mm-hmm. Between the Clinton campaign and the DNC. Again, I never expected otherwise. I think a lot of these Bernie folks thought that they could fight the establishment, but that they wouldn't actually have to fight the establishment.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of, I don't understand that. Of course the DNC was going to collude with the Clinton campaign. What did you expect?
Right.
But still, they should have been fair brokers, and they weren't. Okay, fine. But we've been through that. Heads rolled. There's been accountability. The other thing, of course, is that there's all sorts of untoward goings-on between campaigns and their super PACs. We know that's happening on both sides mm-hmm. of the aisle. It's happening everywhere by all campaigns.
Mm-hmm.
So it's yes, we need to do something about that, and Clinton has been on the record that we need stronger regulations on that. So, okay. And then the third thing, like I said, is just this stuff about how people reading tea leaves into what Clinton really believes versus what she says she believes and whether she's actually as progressive as she campaigned during the primary. And the speeches give a bunch of evidence, at least on the issue of Wall Street, that she's significantly more sort of centrist on those mm-hmm. issues than she maybe made herself appear during the primary, which, again, should not come as a surprise to anyone. And this is sort of where I come down, right? What's been frustrating with a lot of the accusations from the Bernie people, and certainly from the entire right wing, is this view of Hillary Clinton as this scheming, corrupt politician who is pay to play mm-hmm. and taking bribes and all this stuff. And intelligent critics of Clinton were never really making those accusations.
And there's no evidence, David, I got to get out. I mean, because there really is no evidence to support that point of view, at least not yet. And there's going to be more. So I'm open to more when it shows up, as I know you are, David. But so far, I'm seeing kind of a big nothing burger. Sounds like you're seeing an 80% nothing burger.
Yeah, mostly. mostly a nothing burger. And what there is, it should frankly come as no surprise to anyone. Basically confirmation of what most intelligent people already knew was happening and should not really be a surprise to anyone. And certainly nothing that betrays the sort of allegations of, she's so corrupt that everyone's trying to bandy about. There's really nothing there. She's a center-left politician.
David Atkins, center-left politician, deal with it. Exactly. That's what she is. David Atkins, writer, researcher, campaign professional, now blogging at Washington Monthly's Political Animal, and with our friend Digby at digbysblog.blogspot.com. Find David's work at WashingtonMonthly.com and on the Twitters at David O. Atkins. Thank you, brother. Really good to talk to you. Appreciate your work as ever. And come back and disagree with me as much as you can in the future.
You too, Brad. Thanks.
Thanks, man. All right, a quick break, and we're back with more Bradcast right after this. I'm Brad Friedman. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Ran long, as usual. So we will have to get to Trump declaring war on the GOP another day.
Who knows if it'll still be that way by tomorrow.
Oh, it will. He says the shackles are off. You mean they've been on up until now? Really? But this time, we talked about GOP civil war for a long time. This time, boy, it really seems to be happening. That said, we don't have time to get into detail, so we'll just end with a couple of John Oliver 2 weeks ago on HBO's, not Real Time, what's it called? Last Week Tonight had two clips from John. Here first, what he said about 2 weeks ago about election 2016.
Just do me a favor. Look up into the sky right now. Higher. No, higher still. Do you see that? Way up there. Way up above the clouds. That's rock bottom. And we are currently way down here.
Yes.
Not that it makes it any better. Yes. Not that it makes it any better.
Right on the money. That was 2 weeks ago. And then the Access Hollywood tape came out of Donald Trump, his hot mic tape. And then John Oliver followed it up this weekend with this.
Yes, that is audio of Donald Trump in 2005 telling a giggling Billy Bush that one of the perks of fame is that he can grab women's genitalia without permission. And let me just remind you that last Sunday, I told you if you looked above the clouds, you would see rock bottom. But if you look up there now, just way, way, way up there, all the way up high, you will see right up in the distance where we were this time last week. Because since then, we have sunk so low, we are breaking through the Earth's crust where drowning in boiling magma will come as sweet, sweet relief.
We'll be back with more boiling magma tomorrow on the broadcast. Until then, my thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, to my guest today, David Atkins of Washington Monthly, and to you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It's greatly appreciated. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it for free, as ever, at bradblog.com, or you can subscribe, have it sent to you automatically via iTunes or your favorite podcast site. When you stop by any of those sites, leave a comment, a review, say something nice about us, makes it a little easier for everyone else to find us, or say something not so nice about us if you don't want anybody to find us. That's fine too. You can drop me email, I'm bradcast@bradblog.com, and you can find me on the Facebooks and the Twitters at TheBradBlog. Until we hit rock bottom again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.